This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
On this Labor Day, what happens when workers have to supply their own AC? Relevant on another day of triple-digit heat in parts of the West. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Baltimore today, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 7th of September. Good to have you with us this Labor Day. The holiday weekend brought a record-busting heat wave to much of the West. Los Angeles recorded its highest temperature ever, with part of the city reaching 121 degrees yesterday. And it's been a hotter-than-average summer across the country, one that many workers experienced from home instead of in their climate-controlled offices. So how have remote workers been coping without industrial-grade HVAC systems? From the Workplace Culture Desk, now located in one very hot apartment, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has the story.
The decades-old window AC in my living room has been a godsend while working from home this summer. But it sounds sort of like a jet engine. It definitely is an Energy Star certified. So I try to tough it out with fans until at least lunchtime. Same for Anna Chen, who works from home for LA's transit agency. She sometimes answers emails lying on her cool tile floor and reminisces about her frozen office.
I usually have to keep like a little cardigan or something. That is one of the things I think I really do miss.
Tyler Knight, a product manager for an LA entertainment company, is working in a studio attached to his garage, which he says heats up to about 85 by mid-morning. He turns on his portable AC only when he gets really desperate.
There's that moment late in the afternoon where you're already sort of dragging a little bit and the heat just doesn't help.
An analysis by Reardon Frost at Harvard found that electricity use has decreased overall during the pandemic, but residential energy use is up.
So basically, there has been a transfer of burden from the commercial and industrial sectors to the residential sector.
Yeah, that was an air conditioner you heard in the background, and workers are, for the most part, paying for that cool air.
Most states actually do not have reimbursement requirements with respect to what employers have to pay to employees who work from home.
Jeffrey Ruzal is an employment law attorney in New York. He says some states, like California and Illinois, have required employers to pay for things like cell phone bills or internet service. But he thinks the current situation could force a change.
We are going to see sort of a closer look to see whether there should be consideration of air conditioning and other electricity usage from working from home scenarios.
Because as hard as it may be to imagine now from a steamy home office, a cold winter and its heating bills are just around the corner. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
I don't have to tell you this holiday weekend is typically a big one for travel. But if you're among the more than half of Americans who canceled their Labor Day plans this year, according to a survey from NerdWallet, or even if you didn't make plans to begin with, you're not the only one who might be feeling disappointed. The American Hotel and Lodging Association is out with a new report showing just how badly the pandemic continues to depress demand. 4 in 10 hotel employees are still not working. 2/3 of hotels remain less than half full. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on what the industry is up against.
Kevin King lives with his wife and three children outside of Buffalo, New York. He says they were hoping to get out of town for the holiday before his oldest starts kindergarten on Wednesday.
We looked at hotel prices. Hotel prices looked good, but we just couldn't pull the trigger. We didn't feel comfortable in a hotel.
He knows that hotels are cleaning more and trying to limit the contact between guests and employees, but...
Hallways and elevators are the things that scared us the most. Not sure how you socially distance if somebody's coming down the hallway.
King says a lot of the fun for his kids is hanging out in the lobby and running through the hallways. Michael Knoll teaches economics at Texas Tech University. He says that aspect of staying at a hotel just isn't appealing in the context of COVID-19.
All hotels lost, but the hotels that have done the least worst are those basic drive-in, drive-out, get-out-of-here hotels.
There's also a lot less business travel these days, so hotels aren't getting that revenue either. Chip Rogers is CEO of the American Hotel and Lodging Association. He says hotel workers are paying the price.
It's those large urban centers with so many employees that are being hit the worst. And with their occupancy levels, you know, down in the 30s and revenue drops of 70%, that's why you're seeing such massive job loss.
He says one positive, if there is one right now for the hotel industry, is that if many people can work from anywhere, that means they can also work from hotels. That's the idea behind the new hotel booking platform, Hotels by Day. Giannis Moti is that company's CEO.
We now have over 40 million new users that potentially could be using hotel rooms for the day.
He says the idea is to monetize every part of the hotel, so users can book a meeting room, a gym pass, or even a spot at the pool for a day. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a day of rest after Friday's big slide. We'll have details on the global markets when we do the numbers. In the ongoing conversation about racism in our country, Wall Street is among the industries facing pressure to diversify its ranks, especially in leadership positions. At Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and Morgan Stanley, to name a few, reports say less than 3% of executives and senior managers are Black. But what about the government officials who regulate those companies? Right now, only one of the federal government's politically appointed financial regulators is Black. Rodney Hood is head of the National Credit Union Administration. And a new report from Georgetown University outlines how white men have dominated financial regulation for generations. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
Since the New Deal, only 10 of 327 top financial regulators appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate were Black. These regulators oversee Wall Street at the Fed, the FDIC, Securities and Exchange Commission. Georgetown University law professor Chris Brummer looked at diversity at 7 federal agencies.
Our methodology was just designed to identify, to paraphrase the musical Hamilton, who's in the room when it happens.
And who's not in the room.
About 3% of all regulators, of all financial regulators, have been Black. And that headline number was really jarring.
But these numbers aren't surprising for Paul Thornell. He was a Senate staffer in the 1990s. He's been in the rooms where things happened. But he says, as a Black man, he was the exception in those rooms.
I know that there are not met many people that look like me in them.
Senators tend to support people for top financial regulator jobs whom they know, like Senate staffers.
There are just fewer Black and brown people who have those longstanding relationships with senators because few Black and brown people have had top jobs in the Senate.
Thornell says without diverse voices around the table, those at the table can hurt communities they're trying to help. Attorney Petal Walker was chief counsel to a commissioner on the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. She grew up in the 1980s in Jamaica, Queens, a diverse, poorer neighborhood on the outskirts of New York City. Walker says that experience influenced her perspective because she realized that too much market risk could lead to a crisis with spikes in unemployment.
If we don't properly oversee the market, if there's too much risk in one area, there's not enough collateral in another area, those things can create the crisis of the future. And when those jobs are lost, that the people who are most vulnerable really feel it.
Walker says she was very aware of how the decisions financial regulators made would ultimately affect individuals who may never get a seat at the table. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The iPhone 12 is expected to drop next month, and as usual with these releases, Apple is counting on a certain number of customers just upgrading, no questions asked. That was not the case when it came to cutting-edge technology in the 20th century. How companies and ad agencies went about convincing us to buy their devices is the subject of a new photo book, Do You Compute? Ryan Munguia is co-author.
I think that it was a big challenge for ad agencies, the people who were making the ads, to present the material in an interesting way. I mean, the concept of selling the future, or at the time what was a very abstract concept to many people, was a challenge. And how did these companies do that? One of the first ads is an IBM advertisement from the mid-1930s for one of their business machines, which is essentially a calculator. Visually speaking, there's a big illustration of a punched card, which was how information was delivered through these little holes in the card. And below that, there's another illustration of a factory with sort of smoke coming out of the chimneys. You get this very sort of industrial feel from it. Overlapping that, there's big headline text which reads, "Record the voice of your business." Followed by that is lots and lots of sales copy. These really early computer ads were almost exclusively marketed towards large corporations, business people, and the only place you could really find them was in Fortune magazine, which was a trade magazine for business people. So there's an IBM ad from 1996. To me, it just shows not only how much advertising had changed in 50 years, but how much the public's perception of computers and how far computing had come in that time as well. The ad itself is what looks like a box of laundry detergent, almost like Tide, but instead it says Instant Website. It could have appeared in Entertainment Weekly or Rolling Stone or a place like that. The product they're advertising is a server. But in contrast to the earlier ad from 1936, this ad doesn't explain the technology and lots of sales copy. It's very visual. It's very simple. It's more about branding at this point. I mean, the ad has a very youthful, kind of vibrant appearance. It's crazy how far things had come. One of the most interesting things to me about when looking at this collection of images as a whole is how computers were essentially brought to market through by way of print. And as computers developed throughout the second half of the 20th century, they started to replace print in a way. And I wouldn't say that it's made it completely obsolete, but a lot of the way that we consume media these days is through digital means.
If you want to see the ads Ryan Munguia was describing from his book, Do You Compute?, check out our website, marketplace.org. Coming up.
At first, we didn't really see a lot of commentary about it. It felt very silent.
And when you're trying to start a conversation, that can be unnerving. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets were closed for the Labor Day holiday. In Asia, stocks were down, with the Shanghai Composite off 1.8%. In Europe, London's FTSE picked up 2.3%. Germany's DAX rose 2%. Here's a Labor Day number for you, 35. That's the percentage of U.S. wage and salary workers who belonged to a union in the year 1954, the peak of the labor movement, according to Pew Research. Today, the Labor Department puts that number at just over 10%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Talking about money is never easy, which is why many of us avoid it at all costs. But those conversations, especially with kids, can be really important, especially at a time like this, when millions are out of work and struggling to pay the rent or put food on the table. Dr. Shipra Parikh is a clinical social worker and teaches at the University of Chicago's School of Social Service Administration. And we called her up for some advice. Dr. Parikh, welcome to the program.
I appreciate it, and I'm glad to be here.
So it obviously is going to depend a lot on the particular kid, but is there an age when it's appropriate to start having more serious conversations with kids about money and the role it plays in our lives?
I think that it's less of a question of when and more of a question of how, because kids at any age start to develop an understanding of how the world works, and money is a big part of that. I also think that money is very bound up with emotions and with other things that, you know, kind of families need to talk about with kids, like justice issues, identity, history and politics. And so it can be woven in to lots and lots of conversations from a young age, and you can kind of think about really how to tailor it at different ages rather than when is the right time to start. Certainly when kids start asking questions about money, that's one good time to think about how to give them really intentional responses.
Well, and kids pick up on a lot too, right? So even if we're not talking about it, they may be picking up signals from us about our own worries about money.
Absolutely. They're going to learn from what they see the adults in their life doing, just as much as they will from kind of what is also said. So I think a reminder for families is to definitely try to make explicit what feels, you know, in some ways, what you've always done or what was taught to you, and try to think about replicating things that really worked in your family. Also feeling freedom to kind of create your own family culture and feel free to change some of the things about how money was handled or how it was taught. And think about creating that different culture with your kids.
I wonder if you can, we can use a sort of a concrete example. You know, let's say I take my kid to the store and they want to get something that we really can't afford. What's the best way to sort of talk about that without, you know, worrying a child about your financial situation?
Well, sometimes we can't avoid worry. We have so many families in this country living underneath the poverty line. But I think a little bit of worry and a little bit of stress is okay for kids. They actually really should have their parents teach them that it's not about avoiding stress, but it's about learning how to manage it. Kids eat up honesty. I mean, they know when they're getting it. They know when they're not. So I think that's a great opportunity for a kid to connect with their parent is when they know they're being told the truth about something, even if it's hard.
A lot of families are having some really difficult conversations about money right now, with job losses, lost income, uncertainty. Mm-hmm. You know, some families having to move because they can't pay their mortgage or their rent. Do you have any advice for dealing with those conversations in a way that's honest, but also, you know, provides the security that kids really need when they're young?
Yeah, that's such an important conversation that's happening in so many homes right now. And I think, first of all, developmentally, kids from a very young age need to be able to feel that there's something to look forward to. For families who financially are struggling, you know, maybe you don't know where you're going to live, but you know that your family is going to be together. So trying to focus on the things that kids can have some control over, even if it's short term, and then thinking about feeling loved, you know, those things don't change with money.
Yeah. Another conversation that's been going on, you know, on the show and in society is about the racial wealth gap. And I'm curious, you know, if you have thoughts about how to talk to young people about that, and how that conversation might look different, you know, for families of different races.
Well, I think money was and is a tool of an oppressive system. And so when we think about, you know, how bound up it is with our history and justice, race, class, all of these kind of dimensions of how we live, you know, what happens? We have this kind of generationally and over time, this systematic pattern of people who are denied generational wealth acquisition. And I think, to your point, each of these conversations is going to be different. And the lens that it's going to take for a family who's lower income, those kids probably have had a lot of implicit teaching about what that looks like already. It's been embodied in their family. That kid is going to need to be taught in a very different way than a kid who hasn't had to think about that kind of responsibility. If you have a family where your kids don't have to worry about food on the table and they can have an allowance and they can have, you know, disposable income, I think there's a responsibility those families have to really help their kids see themselves as part of a larger system. And for that conversation not to be values driven, like, you know, if you work hard, you won't be poor. Those kinds of singular causal explanations are really very racist in nature. So we have to really understand what justice looks like. We have to work towards justice in whatever sphere of influence we have.
Dr. Shipra Parikh is a clinical social worker and an associate instructional professor at the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration. Thank you so much.
And thank you so much for having me.
We've got a new podcast for kids and their families all about those money questions that can be hard to answer. It's called Million Bazillion. The first season is out now, wherever you get your podcasts. So it's Labor Day, I may have mentioned, and for a lot of us, our jobs and careers are a part of who we are. But sometimes identity and work can come to a head. And as this country and this economy reckon with race, many Black professionals in different industries are drawing attention to how they're valued or not in their fields. In some cases, this has taken the form of an open letter.
I'm Wayman Singleton, and I am a storyboard artist working in animation, currently at Disney Television Animation, and also a co-founder of Black and Animated.
Hello, hello. My name is Brianna Williams, and I am a production coordinator at Disney Television Animation as well. And I am also one of the co-founders of Black and Animated.
We, as Black and Animated, first started out as a podcast. We felt that we didn't see a lot of
ourselves represented in animation.
Minus like maybe one or two names that you hear a lot, like Floyd Norman or Bruce W. Smith, those guys. They're great, great people, but it's like I could count on like one hand just the amount of Black like lead creatives. So we just wanted to sort of give back. So that way, like folks who are in college now or like trying to get in could have some of the information that we didn't have. So a lot of that advocacy that we're trying to do as an organization now, we try to provide access to job postings, to industry professionals that are Black themselves or allies. So that way they can interact with the up and coming Black folks trying to get in the industry.
We wrote an open letter to studios talking about the Black creatives or Black employees of these studios and just trying to make studios aware of how you're treating the Black folks that are in your studio and how you might be treating the hiring process.
The point of that open letter is to just make sure these studios are held accountable for, you know, you need to check on your Black employees. You need to look inward and it really is a shame that it took like Black trauma and Black death for all of these studios to really understand what's going on. Maybe there is a problem here.
At first, we didn't really see a lot of like commentary about it. Like it felt very silent. As we waited, there was definitely the positive response, like people in the community just saying, this is great. This is amazing.
Like we were happy for the support, but we're like, where's the conversation, you know? That is a touchy subject, which sure, fair, but I mean, I can't turn off being Black and that's a part of like my day to day. So like sometimes I have to talk about this, you know? And perhaps a lot of the silence is coming because a lot of the talk is happening internally. I guess the internal stuff does make me a little hopeful, and the studios that have reached out to us that like steps to change will happen. But at the same time, it's kind of like we will be watching and we hope that the follow through happens, you know.
You can find a link to Breonna Williams and Wayman Singleton's open letter to this country's animation community. It's online at marketplace.org. This final note, $20 million. That's the estimated box office take for the new sci-fi movie Tenet in its first weekend in North American theaters. Not too bad for the middle of a pandemic, especially given that indoor theaters are still closed in big markets like Los Angeles and New York. Directed by Christopher Nolan, known for Dunkirk and Inception, Tenet is the first big Hollywood release to hit actual theaters since March. And though a Nolan film might bring in more than twice as much during normal times, that's still a lot of people willing to sit in a room full of strangers wearing a mask for 2.5 hours. All right, we got to go. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. I'm Amy Scott. Kai Rizdahl will be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.